The San Joaquin's problem is unique, an ingenious revenge by nature, in the minds of some, on a valley whose transformation into the richest agricultural region in the world was wrought at awesome cost to rivers, fish, and wildlife. Several times in the relatively recent geologic past, within the last couple of million years, the valley was a great inland sea, thick with diatomaceous life and tiny suspended sediments which settled near the middle of the gently sloping valley floor. Compressed and compacted, the stuff formed an almost impervious layer of clay that now underlies close to 2 million acres of fabulously productive irrigated land. In the middle of the valley, the clay membrane is quite shallow, sometimes just a few feet beneath the surface soil. When irrigation water percolates down, it collects on the clay like bathwater in a tub. In hydrologists' argo, it has become perched water. Since the perched water does not have a chance to mingle with a relatively pure aquifer beneath the clay, it may become highly saline, as in Iraq. The more the farmers irrigate, the higher it rises. In places, it has reached the surface, killing everything around. There are already thousands of acres near the southern end of the valley that look as if they had been dusted with snow. Not even weeds can grow there. An identical fate will ultimately befall more than 1 million acres in the valley unless something is done. For many years, the planners in the state and federal water bureaucracies talked about the need for a master drain to carry the perched water out of the San Joaquin Valley. It is more accurate to say that their reports have talked about it, while the officials, whose main concern was building more dams to satisfy the demands of the irrigators, ignored the need for drainage, because neither they nor, they guessed, the public and the farmers could face the cost. In the early and mid-1970s, says von Skilfgaarde, the state's position was that no drainage problem exists. The early reports all said that the state water project makes no sense without a drain, because it would add inevitably to the perched water problem. But the public doesn't read reports, so no one mentioned them. Then, a few years ago, when the problem began threatening to become critical, there was suddenly an awful drainage problem that threatened the future of agriculture in California. Today, 3 decades after the first report spoke of the need for a huge valley-wide drainage system, no such system exists. A modest-sized spur, called the San Luis Drain, was partially completed as a part of the Westlands Water District, which, by introducing a prodigious amount of new surface water into a relatively small area, threatened to waterlog the land's downslope. But the water carried off by the San Luis Drain has nowhere to go until a master drain is built. For a while, it was dumped into a man-made swamp called Kesterson Reservoir, near the town of Los Banos, which slowly filled and evaporated according to the intensity of the valley heat and the irrigation cycle. From the air, the reservoir, when it was full, was an attractive sight to migrating waterfowl, which descended on it by the tens of thousands as their ancestors once descended by the many millions on the valley's primordial marshes and shallow lakes. The presence of all of those coots, geese, and ducks at Kesterson Reservoir gave the Bureau an idea about how to solve one of the most daunting problems associated with the master drain, its enormous cost. By the time the San Luis Drain, a modest portion of the proposed master drain, is completed, its price tag will be more than $500 million. In 1984, Interior Secretary William Clark made an offhand projection that solving the drainage problem valley-wide could end up costing $4 to $5 billion. That comes to about $5,000 an acre to rescue the affected lands, which is more than any of the land is worth. The farmers, a number of whom are corporations or millionaires, are understandably loath to pay the bill. If one wrote off a third of the cost as a wildlife and recreational benefit, however, it would be easier to swallow. That is exactly what the Bureau and California's Department of Water Resources, in a 1979 interagency study entitled Agricultural Drainage and Salt Manage in the San Joaquin Valley, proposed to do in the case of the Master Drain, which in that report was projected to cost $1.26 billion in 1979 dollars. Ascribing annual benefits of $92 million to the Master Drain, the Bureau and the state's Department of Water Resources elected to write off about a third of that total, or $31.7 million, as a non-reimbursable benefit payable by the taxpayers for the creation of artificial marshes. If one were to divide the number of ducks which might be expected to use those man-made wetlands into $31.7 million, they would become very expensive ducks indeed. When the Bureau's dams went up, regulating the rivers and allowing the marshlands to be dried up, about 93% of the Central Valley's original wetlands are gone, it conveniently ignored the economic value of the millions of ducks whose habitat would be ruined. But later, when it became convenient to overvalue their worth, economic alchemy turned them into gold. Due to a distressing twist of fate, however, the Bureau and California may consider themselves lucky if they succeed in writing off any part of the master drain to wildlife benefits. Sometime in 1982, hunters and biologists around Kesterson Reservoir began to observe that many overwintering birds seemed lethargic and sick, so ravaged by some strange malady that they could not even float on the water, and often drowned. At first, duck hunters and conservationists put forth an explanation that the farm lobby had always pooh-poohed, that pesticides and other chemical wastes in the sump water were making the birds die. By 1984, however, biologists were quite certain that the main cause of the ducks' awful fate was selenium, a rare mineral, toxic in small doses, that occurs in high concentrations in southern coast range soils. Exactly those soils which, washing down from the mountains over eons, form the Westlands Water District. The San Francisco Chronicle, which has carried on a long, bitter battle against water exports to the valley in Southern California, has played the story for all it is worth. But none of its news stories and editorials had quite the impact of a poignant front-page photograph of a gorgeous dying male pintail duck at Kesterson Reservoir. A duck about to sink like a doomed boat to the bottom of the poisoned man-made marsh its presence is to subsidize. Since there can be only one ultimate destination for the wastewater carried by the master drain, San Francisco Bay, the spectacle at Kesterson has infuriated many of the 5 million people who reside in the Bay Area. They may pollute the bay badly enough themselves, even if they do not admit it, but to have a bunch of farmers grown wealthy on their water and subsidized by their taxes, sending it back to the bay full of toxic waste, selenium, boron, and salt, that is intolerable. The farmers, who have been stuck with much of their toxic runoff since Kesterson was closed, might reject such reasoning as simplistic and emotional. But the fact is that the people of the Bay Area appear to have the political clout to prevent the drain from ever reaching there, and they seem determined to use it. It matters little that the salts in the wastewater, the selenium and boron and pesticides are another matter, would hardly affect the salinity of a great bay into which the ocean rushes every day. What matters is that the San Joaquin Valley farmers asked for water and got it, asked for subsidies and got them, and now want to use the bay as a toilet. To their urban brethren by the ocean, living a world apart, all of this smacks of a system gone mad. The one irrigated civilization of antiquity that remained intact for thousands of years was Egypt, and we are now reasonably certain why. Every year, the Nile, the world's most reliable river, would engorge itself in a spring flood and cover most of Egypt's agricultural land. The floods would both carry off the salts and deposit a fresh layer of silt. The farmers would then rush to plant their crops, which grew lavishly on the residual moisture and the perfect soil. In the 1960s, however, the Egyptians, pumped up with a sense of grandiose destiny by Gamal Abdel Nasser, decided to build a high dam on the Nile at Aswan. The Soviet Union helped them do it against the United States' advice. The result has been described as the worst ecological mistake committed in one place by mankind. The spring floods are gone. The nutrient-rich silts no longer come. The Nile sardine fishery in the Mediterranean is going extinct. Bilharzia, or schistosomiasis, a gruesome disease borne by a snail that thrives in slack waters in Africa, is rampant. The reservoir is silting up quite rapidly due to erosion from primitive agriculture upriver. Irrigation canals, meanwhile, are being scoured by the silt-free water released by the dam, and the salts have arrived. With their copious new supply of year-round irrigation water, the Egyptian farmers have been irrigating madly, and the water table, increasingly poisoned by salts, is rising dangerously. Recently, Egypt hired a group of American engineers and agronomists, among whom was former Reclamation Commissioner Floyd Domity, to help them figure out a solution. "Goddamn crazy Russians," was Domity's response when I asked him what things were like over there. Anyone should have seen that Egypt wouldn't be able to handle the effects of that dam. The Egyptians now have no choice other than to install drainage, which they can ill afford, partly because schistosomiasis has become a national epidemic, costing them some $600 million a year. The hydrologic engineer Arthur F. Pillsbury, writing in Scientific American in 1981, noted that Egypt, having avoided the fate of its sister civilizations all these centuries, is now faced with the universal problem of keeping salts from accumulating in the irrigated fields. In that same article, Pillsbury also wrote, "In order to maintain and ensure the long-term viability of irrigated agriculture, and to provide enough water to carry the salts to the ocean or some other natural sink, the development of water resources should be intensified. Before man began harnessing the rivers, the seasonal floods were highly effective in carrying salts to the ocean and keeping the river basin in reasonably good salt balance. Today, with river flows being regulated by storage systems and with high consumptive use of the released water, there is not enough waste flow left to achieve anything approaching balance. The salt is being stored, in one way or another, within the river basins. Unless the lower rivers are allowed to reassert their natural function as exporters of salt to the ocean, today's productive land will eventually become salt-encrusted and barren." In the end, Pillsbury concluded, there is only one answer. Eventually, some grand-scale water diversion concept will be needed. In 1946, after participating in a conference involving 24 eminent hydrologists and engineers, Dr. Charles P. Berkey had a moment of epiphany. Berkey was, at the time, one of the foremost hydrologists in the world. Newberry Professor Emeritus of Geology at Columbia University, he had been a consultant to the City of New York on its Catskill and Neversink water supply projects, and had a list of accomplishments and credentials four times as long as his arm. A list which had kept him so busy, he never had a chance to contemplate the implications of his life's work until he was well into advanced age. Then it came to him, a sunburst of perception, a giant semantic leap. What prompted Berkey's enlightenment was a talk delivered at the conference by J.C. Stevens, then the president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. Berkey was so dumbstruck by what Stevens had to say that he drafted a response as soon as he got back to his desk at Columbia, a response which reads more like a confession of blindness or an admission of personal failing than anything else. This is part of what he had to say. Although the principles involved in the paper by Mr. Stevens are well known, it is not certain that the implications are fully appreciated by many, even in responsible relation to them. The factual data had been long known to the writer, but no statement before this one had brought so forcibly to mind their importance and bearing on long-range planning. The United States has virtually set up an empire on impounded and redistributed water. The nation is encouraging development, on a scale never before attempted, of lands that are almost worthless except for the waters that can be delivered to them by the works of man. There is building up, through settlement and new populations, a line of industries foreign to the normal resources of the region. Effort to use water on desert lands is not a new adventure by any means, but a program involving development of a great region, involving thereby a large new population under conditions that carry elements of certain future destructive encroachment in limited and computable time, that is new. Not only is it new, but in some of the implications it is fairly astonishing. The nearest thing in that respect was the settlement of the Western High Plains in earlier days by people who believed that these Dust Bowl lands could be farmed in the same manner as those they came from in the central Mississippi Valley, and no voice was raised to warn them. That was to be a vast and prosperous empire, too. For the first time, after reading this paper, the long-range significance of the suffocating effect produced by accumulating silt in all these reservoirs was borne down on the writer. He had been so much taken with the fine things being done that he had not fully appreciated the fact that the program carried elements of destruction, sure to bring some kind of ending. It was always evident, of course, that there were severe limitations, but it was too easy to overlook or belittle this element of damage from within. The experience of founding, in difficult surroundings, settlements which finally grew into influence and power, is not new, and neither is their decline, and even their ending. In the past, however, none of them carried, along with the agents that built them up, such relentless elements of destruction as in the present reclamation of arid lands. The astonishing thing is that the life of these relief works promises to be so short. One could forget it if the time vista were indefinite, or if there were promise of 1,000 years. In that time, most human subsistence and economic lines take new turns and become adjusted. But in some of these projects, typical of the average more or less, the beginnings of decline loom already, and will certainly grow into a serious problem in 3 or 4 generations. One wonders how many settlers gathering around these projects appreciate what it means. Of course, if one is able to divorce his interests from the future, there is nothing to worry about. In this generation, and the next, an upgrade can be maintained. One can claim, and it is true, that much has been added to the world, but the longer-range view in this field, as in many others, is threatened by apparently incurable ailments, and this one, of slowly choking to death with silt, is the most stubborn of all. There are no permanent cures. The conference Berkeley and Stevens had attended, The Future of Lake Mead and Elephant Butte Reservoir, was more precisely a summit meeting on the subject of mud. Before Hoover and Elephant Butte dams were built, the Rio Grande and the Colorado River ran chocolate brown in the spring and any time a cloudburst occurred somewhere in the watershed. Now, the water emanating from the penstocks and spillways below the dams was an opalescent blue-green, colored only by the minerals and algae in it. Each year, millions of cubic yards of silt were coming to a dead halt behind both dams. For all their breathtaking immensity, dams are oddly vulnerable things, a vulnerability that is shared and greatly intensified among the millions of people who depend on them. The engineers who have built them have gone to great lengths to make them safe from earthquakes, landslides, and floods, but their ultimate vulnerability, as Berkey wrote, is to silt. Every reservoir eventually silts up. It is only a matter of when. In hard rock terrain with a lot of forest cover, the Sierra Nevada, the Catskill Mountains, a dam may have a useful life of 1,000 years. In some overpopulated nations whose forests are nearly gone and whose farmlands are moving up mountains and whose rivers are therefore thick with silt, reservoirs built after the Second World War may be solid mud before the century's out. The San Mushir Reservoir in China, an extreme case, was completed in 1960 and already decommissioned by 1964, it had silted up completely. The Tehri Dam in India, the 6th highest in the world, recently saw its projected useful life reduced from 100 to 30 years due to horrific deforestation in the Himalaya foothills. In the Dominican Republic, the 80,000-kilowatt Tavera hydroelectric project, the country's largest, was completed in 1973. By 1984, silt behind the dam had reached a depth of 18 meters and storage capacity had been reduced by 40%. In countries suffering from overpopulation, deforestation, which is the primary cause of reservoir siltation, can only be expected to grow worse. As a matter of principle, any place where vegetation is relatively sparse, where soils are erodible, but where 6 inches of rain in a day or 20 inches in a month are not unknown, is a less than ideal place to situate a dam. Those conditions, however, apply to a large part of the Intermountain West, and since the arrival of intensive agriculture, to a great portion of the Middle West as well. The Eel River in California is the most rapidly eroding watershed in North America, partly because the topography is ridden with erodible sediments, partly because of rampant clear-cutting earlier in the century from which the forests may never recover, partly because of stubble grazing by cattle and sheep that is still going on. There is no major dam on any branch of the Eel, at least not yet, but talk of building one there says a lot about what people are willing to ignore. Meanwhile, erosive forces are hard at work in the watersheds of the Missouri River, the Colorado, the Rio Grande, the Platte, the Arkansas, the Brazos, the Colorado of Texas, the Sevier, the Republican, the Pecos, the Willamette, the Gila, rivers on which there are dozens of dams. Earlier in the century, it was thought by some that irrigation in those watersheds might actually slow the rate of erosion by creating more ground cover to hold the soil in place. In the 1920s, however, no one foresaw interest rates so high that farmers pushed to the brink would almost be forced to abandon careful husbandry of the soil for maximum profit. No one foresaw cheap fertilizers that allow land to be plowed year after year, never going fallow. No one foresaw 6-ton tractors that tear up the soil and make it more apt to be carried off. No one foresaw a demand for U.S. agricultural exports that makes it profitable to farm Class 6 land. As a result of all this, and because it was inevitable anyway, the dams are silting up. Black Butte Reservoir, Stony Creek, California. Capacity 1963, 160,009 acre-feet. Capacity 1973, 147,754 feet. Conscious Reservoir, Canadian River, New Mexico. Capacity 1939, 601,112 acre-feet. Capacity 1970, 528,951 acre-feet. Alamogordo Reservoir, Pecos River, New Mexico. Capacity 1936, 156,750 acre-feet. Capacity 1964, 110,655 acre-feet. Lake Waco, Brazos River, Texas. Capacity 1930, 39,378 acre-feet. Capacity 1964, 15,427 acre-feet. Elephant Butte Reservoir, Rio Grande River, New Mexico. Capacity 1915, 2,634,800 acre-feet. Capacity 1969, 2,137,219 acre-feet. Hoover Dam, Colorado River, Arizona, Nevada. Capacity 1936, 32,471,000 acre-feet. Capacity 1970, 30,755,000 acre-feet. San Carlos Reservoir, Gila River, Arizona. Capacity 1928, 1,266,837 acre-feet. Capacity 1966, 1,170,000 acre-feet. Howard Brothers Stock Dam, Driftwood Creek, McDonald, Kansas. Capacity 1959, 26.58 acre-feet. Capacity 1972, 14.18 acre-feet. Ocoee Dam No. 3, Ocoee River, North Carolina. Capacity 1942, 14,304 acre-feet. Capacity 1972, 3,879 acre-feet. Guernsey Reservoir, North Platte River, Wyoming. Capacity 1929, 73,810 acre-feet. Capacity 1957, 44,800 acre-feet. Wilson Dam, Tennessee River, Tennessee. Capacity 1928, 687,000 acre-feet. Capacity 1961, 641,000 acre-feet. Klaus Lake, Center Branch of Rush Creek, Ohio. Capacity 1948, 234 acre-feet. Capacity 1970, 142 acre-feet. In 35 years, Lake Mead was filled with more acre-feet of silt than 98% of the reservoirs in the United States are filling with acre-feet of water. The rate has slowed considerably since 1963 because the silt is now building up behind Flaming Gorge, Blue Mesa, and Glen Canyon dams. The Bureau of Reclamation has an office of sedimentation, which was being run in 1984 by a cheerful fellow named Bob Strand. One wonders whether his good cheer stems from the fact that sedimentation is the one problem the Bureau hasn't really been forced to deal with yet. All of our bigger reservoirs were built with a sedimentation allowance, says Strand. There's enough surplus capacity in them to permit most of the projects to operate according to plan over their payout lifetime. In most cases, that's 50 to 100 years. After that, silt will begin to cut into capacity. It hasn't happened yet to any significant degree. What will Ibiro do when it does happen? We're working on it, says Strand. The dams are wasting assets, says Raphael Kasman, a retired professor of hydrology from Louisiana State University and one of the world's foremost authorities on water. When they silt up, that's it. Can't the mud be removed somehow? Sure, says Kasman, but where are you going to put it? It will wash right back in unless you truck it out to sea. The cost of removing it is so prohibitive anyway that I can't imagine it being done. Do you understand how many coal trains it would take to haul away the Colorado's river annual production of silt? How would you get it out of the canyons? You can design dams to flush out the silts nearest to the dam, but all you get rid of is a narrow profile. You create a little short canyon in a vast plateau of mud. Most of the stuff stays, no matter what you do. The one place with some experience at desilting dams is Los Angeles, which has built a number of flood debris reservoirs around the basin whose capacity it can ill afford to lose. Between 1967 and 1977, the Metropolitan Water District and the Department of Water and Power removed 23.7 million cubic yards of mud from behind those dams. The cost was $29.1 million. At that rate, it would cost more than $1.5 billion in modern money to remove the silt that accumulated in Lake Mead over 30 years, if one could find any place to put it. The average politician, says Luna Leopold, another hydrologist who seems to have some appreciation of the magnitude of the problem, has a time horizon of around 4 years. The agencies are tuned to Congress, so theirs is about the same. No one has begun to think about this yet. But keep in mind, the thousands of big dams were built in this country during a very brief period, between 1915 and 1975. Many are going to be silting up at the same time. There already are some small reservoirs in the east that are mud up to the gunwales. These are little manageable reservoirs, nothing like the big canyon reservoirs we've built in the west. But I haven't heard of anything being done about them. The silt that is now accumulating behind the dams used to settle near the mouths of the rivers. The Mississippi Atchafalaya Delta, which is bigger than New Jersey, is made up entirely of silt from the west and middle west. About half of the sediment that used to reach it every year no longer does. Raphael Kasman, who made a career of studying the delta and may understand it better than anyone else alive, is convinced that a third to half of it will disappear within the next few decades. A significant percentage already has. He also believes the Mississippi will change course, probably by the year 2000, and begin pouring down the Atchafalaya Basin, wiping out many miles of interstate highway and several of the nation's largest gas pipelines. The river has been straitjacketed and robbed of its silt, says Kasman. It's a much more powerfully scouring river than it was. It's just a matter of time before it eats away one of its bends and seeks out a completely new course. Kasman also believes that in an economic sense, such an event could be the greatest peacetime disaster in American history. The only thing that might eclipse it is the silting up of the dams. The answer I have always heard from bureaucrats, says Kasman, is that scientific and technological progress has accelerated at such a tremendous rate that some solution will come along. I don't know what they think. That we're going to have fusion energy pumping out the dams? The only answer I can see is to make the dams higher or build new ones. Right now I can think of few places where it would make economic sense to do that, even if it were feasible. In his book Modern Hydrology, Raphael Kasman has written, "The reservoir construction program, objectively considered, is really a program for the continued and endless expenditure of ever-increasing sums of public money to combat the effects of geologic forces, as these forces strive to reach positions of relative equilibrium in the regime of rivers and the flow of water. It may be that future research in the field of modern hydrology will be primarily to find a method of extricating ourselves from this unequal struggle with minimum loss to the nation. The forces involved are comparable to those met by a boy who builds a castle on the sandy ocean beach next to the water at low tide. It is not pessimism, merely an objective evaluation, to predict the destruction of the castle. Epilogue. A civilization, if you can keep it. In May of 1958, while testifying at Senate hearings on the acreage provisions of the Reclamation Act, the then Associate Commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation, Floyd Dominey, departed both from the issue at hand and from his prepared remarks to lecture some critical Eastern senators on what the federal irrigation program has meant to the American West. "My people came here as farmers and settled in East Hampton, Long Island, in 1710, Dominey began. "As the generations progressed, they moved westward as public lands were opened up and as the West was developed, until my grandfather, Lafayette Dominey, in 1845, was born on a farm in LaSalle County, Illinois, carved from the wilderness by his own father and grandfather. When Lafayette Dominey reached maturity and married and had his first child, who was my father, he wanted a farm of his own, but discovered that within his means he could not acquire one in Illinois. He borrowed $2,000 from a preacher in 1876 and migrated with his small family to Nebraska and took one of the 160-acre homesteads about which we have been speaking. Now, as to the adequacy of that homestead, I would like to have you know that they lived in a sod house. They lived out beyond medical attention, without any of the modern facilities that we feel are desirable for all Americans today. They lost all the girl children in the family to diphtheria. The three male children survived, or else I would not be here. I want you to know that on that 160-acre homestead it took that man from 1876 to 1919 to pay off the $2,000 that he borrowed. When my father reached maturity, he took a homestead in the same area, 160 acres. On that farm, six of us children were born, and six of us reached maturity on the substance of that 160-acre homestead. We had outside plumbing. We did not have deep freezers, automobiles, school buses coming by the door. We walked to school in the mud. We maybe had one decent set of clothes to wear to town on Saturday. You take 160 acres that has to provide automobiles, modern school facilities, taxes for school buses, for good roads, to provide deep freezers, electric stoves, electric refrigerators, the modern conveniences that the farm housewife ought to have and deserves. It puts a much greater demand on the income of that land than was necessary to support us at a subsistence level, prevailing for my father or grandfather. When I became a county agricultural agent, I saw the results of people who had decided this is the utopia for which we seek, and they had left Missouri and Iowa and other places where land was not available. They put their belongings in immigrant cars, and they went to Wyoming and Montana. They took out what was promised to them as an abundant chance for a great family living, 640 dry land acres. I want everyone in this room, and I want this committee, to know that most of those 640 acres could not sustain a family under any reasonable economic conditions that have prevailed then or now. I saw family after family, after devoting 15 or 20 years of valiant effort, forced to sell out and start anew. Considering all this, Dominey went on, how could you view the federal reclamation program as anything less than the salvation of the West? The same 160 acres of flinty, stubbled, profoundly unwelcoming land that couldn't support a family, couldn't create a tax base, couldn't provide even dietary subsistence during drought years, was magically transformed when water was led to it. Could one imagine what the West would be like if there hadn't been a Bureau of Reclamation, if the rivers hadn't been turned out of their beds and allowed to remake that pitiless landscape? It is a question worth thinking about. Nevada is the one western state without any mentionable rivers at all, and perhaps the closest approximation of how things could have remained if the landscape had suffered no improvement. its settlements 100 miles apart, its economy rooted, for lack of a better alternative, in what used to be called Sin, its ghost towns as numerous as those that managed to survive. Of course, in the states with rivers there was plenty of irrigation going on before the Bureau arrived on the scene, but an appalling number of those private ventures were destined to collapse. There were, as Dominey said, tens of thousands of heart-rending farm failures and catastrophic overgrazing on the dry land ranches. Irrigation helped put an end to both. There were all those rivers just wasting water to the Gulf and Pacific. There was the Virgin Colorado, as Dominey liked to say, useless to anyone. Did one prefer the tawdry image of Las Vegas to the palpable miracle of the Imperial Valley? Did one prefer a wild and feckless Colorado to one that measures out steady water and power to 10 million people? Should we not have built Hoover Dam? There are those who might say yes, who would argue that the West should have been left pretty much as it was. At the distant other end of the spectrum are the water developers and engineers who cannot rest while great rivers like the Yukon and the Fraser still run free, for whom life seems to hold little meaning except to subjugate nature, to improve it, to engage it in a contest of wills. For the rest of us, contemplating the modern West presents a dilemma. We mourn what has been lost since Lewis and Clark, the feast of wilderness, the mammoth herds of buffalo, the 50,000 grizzly bears and the 1 million antelope that roamed California, the coastal streams that one could cross on the backs of spawning salmon. On the other hand, to see a sudden unearthly swath of green amid the austere and mournful emptiness of the Mojave Desert or the Harney Basin is to watch one's prejudices against mankind's conquering instinct begin to dissolve. So we want to know, even if it seems an academic matter now, what it all amounts to that we have done out here in the West. How much was sensible? How much was right? Was it folly to allow places like Los Angeles and Phoenix to grow up? Were we insane or far-sighted to build all the dams? And even if such questions seem academic, they lead to an emphatically practical one. What are we going to do next? It isn't easy to get people to think along these lines, at least not yet, because the vulnerable aspect of our desert empire remains for most people, even most Westerners, an abstraction, like the certainty of another giant earthquake along the San Andreas Fault. Drive through Los Angeles and see the millions of lawns and the water flowing everywhere, and the transformation seems immutable. Everything rolls along nonstop, like the seamless ribbons of traffic. It all seems permanent. But then catch a flight to Salt Lake City and fly over Glen Canyon Dam at 30,000 feet, a height from which even this magnificent bulwark becomes a frail thumbnail holding back a monstrous, deceptively placid, man-made sea, and think what one sudden convulsion of the earth, or one crude atomic bomb, or one 500-year flood, which came close to occurring in 1983 and nearly destroyed a spillway under the dam, might do to that fragile plug in its sandstone gorge, and what the sudden emptying of Lake Powell, with its 8.5 trillion gallons of water, would do to Hoover Dam downstream, and what the instantaneous disappearance of those huge life-sustaining lakes would mean to the 13 million people hunkered down in Southern California and to the Imperial Valley, which would no longer exist. But the West's dependence on distant and easily disruptible dams and aqueducts is just the most palpable kind of vulnerability it now has to face. The more insidious forces, salt poisoning of the soil, groundwater mining, the inexorable transformation of the reservoirs from water to solid ground, are, in the long run, a worse threat. If Hoover and Glen Canyon dams were to collapse, they could be rebuilt. The cost would be only $15 billion or so. But to replace the groundwater being mined throughout the West would mean creating an entirely new Colorado River, half again as large as the one that exists. Like so many great and extravagant achievements, from the fountains of Rome to the federal deficit, the immense national dam construction program that allowed civilization to flourish in the deserts of the West contains the seeds of disintegration. It is the old saw about an empire's rising higher and higher and having farther and farther to fall. Without the federal government, there would have been no Central Valley Project, and without that project, California would never have amassed the wealth and creditworthiness to build its own state water project, which loosed a huge expansion of farming and urban development on the false promise of water that may never arrive. Without Uncle Sam, masquerading from the 1930s to the 1970s as a godfather of limitless ambition and means, the seven Ogallala states might never have chosen to exhaust their groundwater as precipitously as they have. They let themselves be convinced that the government would rescue them when the water ran out, just as the Colorado Basin states foolishly persuaded themselves that Uncle Sam would augment their over-appropriated river when it ran dry. The government, the Bureau and the Corps of Engineers, first created a miraculous abundance of water, then sold it so cheaply that the mirage filled the horizon. Everywhere one turned, one saw water, cheap water, inexhaustible water, and when there were more virgin rivers and aquifers to tap, the illusion was temporarily real. But now, the desert is encroaching on the islands of green that have risen within it, and the once mighty Bureau seems helpless to keep its advance at bay. The government is broke, the cost of rescue is mind-boggling, and the rest of the country, its infrastructure in varying stages of collapse, thinks the West has already had too much of a good thing. So the West is finally being forced back onto solutions it should have tried decades ago. The cities are beginning to buy water from farmers. Groundwater regulation is no longer equated with heavy-handed Bolshevism. But to say that a new era has dawned is premature. Poll the rugged individualist members of the Sacramento Rotary Club, and a majority will say that their bankrupt government should by all means build them a $2.5 billion Auburn Dam. There were excesses of both degree and style. For thousands of years, Egyptian farmers irrigated by simple diversions from the Nile, and nothing went badly wrong. Then Egypt built the Aswan High Dam and got waterlogged land, salinity, schistosomiasis, nutrient-starved fields, a dying Mediterranean fishery, and a bill for all of the above that will easily eclipse the value of the irrigation miracle wrought by the dam. In the American West, the Bureau and the Corps fostered a similar style of water development that, though amazingly fruitful in the short run, leaves everyone and everything more vulnerable in the end. Only the federal government had the money to build the big mainstem reservoirs, which will end up being choked by the silt, or at the very least, will require billions of dollars worth of silt retention dams to keep the main reservoirs alive. These smaller reservoirs will, of course, silt up fairly quickly themselves, even assuming it makes economic sense to build them. It was through the federal government that millions of acres of poorly drained land not only were open to farming, but were sold dirt-cheap water. The farmers flooded their fields with their cheap water and made the waterlogging and salt problems even worse. Now that the lands are beginning to succumb to salt, it looks as if the farmers will, in many cases, have to solve things on their own, and a lot of land that cost a fortune to bring into production is going to be left to die. We didn't have to build mainstem dams on rivers carrying vast loads of silt. We could have built more primitive off-stream reservoirs, which is what many private irrigation districts did, and successfully, but the federal engineers were enthralled by dams. We didn't have to mine 10,000 years' worth of groundwater in a scant half-century, any more than we had to keep building 5,000-pound cars with 450-cubic-inch V8s. We didn't have to dump 8 tons of dissolved salts on an acre of land in a year. We could have forsworn development on the most poorly drained lands or demanded that, in exchange for water, the farmers conserve as much as possible. But the Bureau still sells them water so cheaply they can't afford to conserve. To install an efficient irrigation system costs a lot more. The Israelis, who have far too little water to waste any of it, are stunned when they see the consumption of a typical Western farm. And it is no coincidence that most of the water-saving innovations of the past years, such as drip irrigation, originated in Israel instead of here. But the tragic and ludicrous aspect of the whole situation is that cheap water keeps the machine running, The water lobby cannot have enough of it, just as the engineers cannot build enough dams. And how convenient that cheap water encourages waste, which results in more dams. No one loses except, of course, the taxpayers at large. Recently, the magnitude of these losses has finally begun to come to light. In August of 1985, the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, released a report on the Central Valley Project that it commissioned from a team of economists supported by a Ford Foundation grant. Through that report, a window was thrown open for the first time on the kinds of liberties the Bureau has been taking with public funds and the law in order to perpetuate the myth of abundance and keep up the demand for more dams. According to the report, the Bureau not only has been giving its California clients, the nation's richest farmers, cheap water, it has been inventing a whole new realm of subsidies, which are quite possibly illegal, in order to keep the price from going up. For one thing, it adopted years ago a completely unwarranted interpretation of the principle of ability to pay, which is one of the main instruments by which water prices are set. Originally, adjusting water rates according to the farmer's ability to pay meant that the price of water could vary from good years to bad ones, as long as the momentum of the 50-year repayment schedules was maintained. But the Bureau undercharged its clients' farmers so regularly that the CVP repayment schedule had fallen drastically into arrears by 1985. By that year, some three decades after the project was essentially completed, the farmers had repaid a mere $50 million of the $931 million in capital costs that they were obligated to pay back. Remember that the farmers are exempted from paying interest on this amount, a subsidy worth at least a couple of billion dollars in its own right. What is worse, since 1982, payments for water and power have not been sufficient even to cover the operation and maintenance costs of the project, and the Bureau has been cannibalizing the capital cost fund to keep it from running out of operating funds. This, of course, is robbing Peter to pay Paul, and according to the NRDC, it is perfectly illegal. It would have been perfectly legal for the Bureau to raise its water rates. It may even have been required by law, but that was never done. A multi-billion-dollar interest exemption, a repayment schedule allowed to slip drastically toward default, an amazingly magnanimous interpretation of ability to pay, that would seem to be subsidy enough. But the Bureau wouldn't even stop there. A substantial chunk of the project's cost has been written off to fish and wildlife benefits, even though the main impact on fish and wildlife has been a drastic reduction in salmon and waterfowl populations. In addition, the NRDC report disclosed, the Bureau has for years been selling power to the farmers for considerably less than it pays to wheel it down from the dams in the Pacific Northwest. The effect of everything, according to the economists, is that a few thousand farmers will, over the course of 50 years, receive $1.5 billion worth of taxpayer generosity that was never supposed to be theirs. The value of the interest exemption isn't included in this figure. That was their right. And the result, according to the NRDC, is that the repayment of capital costs of the CVP is likely to be zero by the time most of the water contracts expire in the 1990s. The farmers, who were entitled to incredibly cheap water, have ended up getting it nearly free. Who are the beneficiaries of this vast, unintended largesse? The report found that the biggest subsidies, on a farm-by-farm basis, are going to the Westlands Water District, which is where the biggest farmers in the CVP service area happen to reside. The Westlands, in fact, consumes about 25% of the water the project has for sale, enough to supply all of New York City. By the economists' calculations, the true cost of delivering water to Westlands has now reached $97 per acre-foot. The farmers are being charged between $7.50 and $11.80. Taking the average farm size in the district, this translates into a subsidy of around $500,000 per farm per year. That sounds bad enough, but it is even worse than it sounds. Spread across a district, The subsidy to Westlands amounts to something like $217 per acre per year. The average annual revenue produced by an acre of Westlands land is only $290. This means that 70% of the profit on what is supposed to be some of the richest farmland in the world comes solely through taxpayers' subsidization, not crop production. Not only that, but the main Westlands crop was then cotton, which in the 1980s had become very much a surplus crop. So the same subsidies that were helping to enrich some of the wealthiest farmers in the nation were at the same time depressing crop prices elsewhere, and undoubtedly driving unsubsidized cotton farmers in Texas and Louisiana and Mississippi out of business. It was these same Westlands farmers, incidentally, who, with the help of their good friend Senator Alan Cranston and Representative Tony Quello, led the successful effort to expand the acreage limitation from 160 to 960 acres in 1982. Even so, when their 10-year grace period expires in 1992, many will still be in violation of the law unless they sell off their excess lands. Farms of 2,000 and 3,000 acres are commonplace. Farms of 30,000 acres are not unknown. Not a single 160-acre farm exists within its borders. Why such a group of farmers should have received subsidized water in the first place is a good question. After saying all this, it hardly seems worth mentioning that the Westlands Water District's irrigation return flows are the main source of the valley's high levels of selenium, which have been poisoning tens of thousands of waterfowl in the valley wildlife refuges, and from the available evidence, all the way into San Francisco Bay. There, in a nutshell, is how one of the nation's preeminent examples of reform legislation is stood completely on its head. Illegal subsidies enrich big farmers, whose excess production depresses crop prices nationwide, and whose waste of cheap water creates an environmental calamity that could cost billions to solve. And what was the response of the Bureau to the NRDC report? It quibbled about the actual size of the subsidies, but strikingly enough, didn't deny that they are occurring or even that they are illegal, and it didn't deny that the Central Valley Project is at least hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars in debt. Its response was a strange, calm, qualified agreement, as if to say, "Of course this is what has been going on, but it isn't really our fault." In a sense, the Bureau is right. If blame is laid anywhere, it ought to be laid at Congress's door. Congress authorized the Central Valley Project. Congress approved the Westlands contract. Congress persistently refused to reform the Reclamation Act in any way except to enlarge the subsidies and to permit subsidized water to be sold to bigger farms. Congress, instead of offering incentives to conserve water, issued a multi-billion-dollar license to waste it in the form of more and more dams. What cynic can blame it? To Congress, the federal water bureaucracy has been the closest thing to a shmoo, the little creature out of Little Abner that reproduced mightily and lived only to be eaten by us. The dams created jobs, how efficiently is another matter, and made the unions happy. They enriched the engineering and contracting firms, from giants like Bechtel and Parsons to small-time cement pourers in Sioux Falls, and made them happy. They subsidized the irrigation farmers and made them happy. They offered enough water to the cities to make them happy. They gave free flood protection to the real estate developers who ran the booming cities of the West out of their pockets and made them happy. And as a result of all this, the politicians were reelected, which made them happy. No one lost, except the nation at large. What federal water development has amounted to, in the end, is a uniquely productive, creative vandalism. Agricultural paradises were formed out of seas of sand and humps of rock. Sprawling cities sprouted out of nowhere, grew at mad rates, and ended up as Frank Lloyd Wright's sanitary slums. While they were being rescued from the tyranny of the desert, they gave themselves over as slaves to the automobile. Millions of people and green acres took over a region that, from appearances, is unforgivingly hostile to life. It was a spectacular achievement, and its most implacable critics have to acknowledge its positive side. The economy was, no doubt, enriched. population dispersion was achieved. Land that had been dry-farmed and overgrazed and horribly abused was stabilized and saved from the drought winds. Wasting resources, the rivers and aquifers, were put to productive use. The cost of all this, however, was a vandalization of both our natural heritage and our economic future, and the reckoning has not even begun. Thus far, nature has paid the highest price. Glen Canyon is gone. The Colorado Delta is dead. The Missouri bottomlands have disappeared. 9 out of 10 acres of wetlands in California have vanished, and with them, millions of migratory birds. The great salmon runs in the Columbia, the Sacramento, the San Joaquin, and dozens of tributaries are diminished or extinct. The prairie is civilized and is dull. Its last wild features, the pothole marshes in the Dakotas, could all but disappear at the hands of the Garrison Diversion and Sendak projects, if they are ever built. And it didn't happen only in the West. Much the same thing happened in the East, especially in the South, where an incredible diversity and history and beauty in the old river valleys lies submerged under hundreds of featureless reservoirs. The vast oak and cypress swamps of the old South have been dried up, courtesy mainly of the Corps of Engineers, and converted to soybean fields, another crop of which we have an enormous glut. In fact, the Corps of Engineers is responsible for creating a lot more artificial farmland, wisely or unwisely, than the Bureau of Reclamation. By its own estimate, it has converted some 26 million acres of marshy or flood-threatened land, most of it in the East, into permanent crops. Depending on one's point of view, this achievement has been a monstrous travesty against nature, a boon to the local economies, or, the viewpoint most likely held by the Corps of Engineers, a fine opportunity to keep building more drainage projects and dams in order to protect what is only a precarious foothold against the forces of nature. As we discover afresh each day, those forces can only be held at bay, never vanquished, and that is where the real vandalism, the financial vandalism of the future, comes in. Who is going to pay to rescue the salt-poisoned land, to dredge trillions of tons of silt out of the expiring reservoirs, to bring more water to whole regions, whole states, dependent on aquifers that have been recklessly mined, to restore wetlands and wild rivers and other natural features of landscape that have been obliterated now that more and more people are discovering that life is impoverished without them? We won't have to. Our children probably won't have to. But somewhere down the line, our descendants are going to inherit a bill for all this vaunted success. And between a $4 trillion national debt, a good bit of it incurred financing the dams, and the inevitability of expensive energy, it will be a miracle if they can pay it. None of this is to say that we shouldn't have gone out and tried to civilize the arid West by building water projects and dams. It is merely to suggest that we overreached ourselves. What we have achieved may be spectacular. In another sense, though, we achieved the obverse of our goals. The Bureau of Reclamation set out to help the small farmers of the West, but ended up making a lot of rich farmers even wealthier at the small farmers' expense. Through water development, the federal government set out to rescue farmers from natural hardships, droughts and floods, but created a new kind of hardship in the form of a chronic, seemingly permanent condition of agricultural glut. We set out to tame the rivers and ended up killing them. We set out to make the future of the American West secure. What we really did was make ourselves rich and our descendants insecure. Few of them are apt to regret that we built Hoover Dam. On balance, however, they may find themselves wishing that we had left things pretty much as they were. Suppose, though, that it were possible to solve at one stroke all the West's problems with water. Suppose you could import into the American West enough water to allow irrigation to continue, even to expand, for another 300 or 400 years, to continue even after the great dams built during this century have largely silted up. Suppose you had enough surplus water to flush all the accumulated salts out to sea, thereby avoiding the hoary fate of almost every irrigated civilization. Suppose that, in the process of storing all this water behind great dams, you could create between 50,000 and 80,000 megawatts of surplus power, power that would be available for general consumption even after all of the irrigation water had been moved to where it was needed. In 1985, the total installed